Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored. One of them co-authored with my daughter, The Finality of Jesus Christ, and if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage. Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, what about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. One of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study.
We continue our exposition of the book of Exodus. We've come to Exodus 16. We had just read at the end of the last chapter in verse 27, and they, that is the children of Israel, they're just barely in the wilderness on the east side of the Red Sea. They've just had a major water problem where they grumbled at Moses. God tested them there and had Moses throw a tree into the bitter waters at Marah, and that healed the waters. He has not yet given them the law that will be given later in time and in the Exodus narrative. They've not yet come to Sinai, so the Lord just gave them this general rule. And God had said, if you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, that is, whatever it happens to be, and will do right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments and keep all of his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I had put on the Egyptians. For I am the Lord your healer. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms, and they camped there beside the waters. Chapter 16, we have them setting out from Elim. We asked the question at the end of the last program, what is this little stopover in this oasis at Elim telling us? I think it's telling us about the rhythms of the spiritual life. I spoke about that earlier. In God's ways of dealing with us, there are times in the valley, times on the mountaintop, times of adversity, and then there are seasons of prosperity, times of rigor, followed by times of rest. I said that there was a tendency for the Lord to alternate good times and bad. That's not a law. But it's a tendency that in the spiritual life and our walk with God we see so often, and we see it in the people of God in the revelational narratives. Here the numbers may be symbolic of completeness of divine provision in an oasis of blessing. The term Elim means great trees. They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Zin. which is between Elim and Sinai. They came there on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. And once again, true to their form, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by pots of flesh, where we ate bread to the full. For you, Moses, Aaron, you guys have brought us out here into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. We'll stop right there. Exactly 1 month into the exodus from Egypt, exactly 1 month from the night of the first Passover, the encampment of the Israelites moves on from the fertile, well-watered spot in the midst of the wilderness of Zin, between Elim and Mount Sinai. The Sinai Peninsula consisted of four desert areas, the desert of Shur, the desert of Sinai, the desert of Paran, and the desert of Zin. The exact territory included in the latter, the wilderness of Zin, where we find them now going, that exact territory is a matter of dispute. Some scholarly debates, folks, have little bearing on the teaching purposes of the text, so I dead sure do not intend to belabor them. Now it is time to move on from Elim. Life there was a pleasant reprieve from the bitterness of Marah, where they had no water, until the Lord healed the waters there of their brackishness. Elim was a good place. Everybody was happy and comfortable there. Now, once again, in the rhythms of our walk with God, that's about to change. On the horizon is a new test of faith. As I said in verse 2, we see that the congregation of Israel, which is outwardly believing but inwardly unbelieving, they remain true to their ugly spiritual form, a new bump in the road, and, quote, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Hebrew word for grumble means to murmur in an angry, balky spirit. Does that sound familiar? George Bush, commentator on Exodus, once wrote, "How prone are people to fret and murmur under present inconvenience? That which troubles us for the moment is the greatest of all troubles," that is, in our own minds. Past dangers, past deliverances, past supports, past comforts are all forgotten. Our minds have a tendency to dwell upon present evil, and our tempers are irritable, fretful, and impatient. This time, the issue was not about water that they lacked, but food, and they were most unhappy about it. Facing the specter of famine, again, the congregation of Israel tears into Moses and Aaron for getting them into this mess. They even questioned their motives, that is, of Moses and Aaron. It's one thing when people feel your head is bad, but when they question the goodness of your heart, that really hurts, and I'm certain it stung Moses especially. Would that we had died by God's hand in the land of Egypt when we sat by pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness. You must be trying to kill this whole assembly with hunger, as I paraphrase lately. Folks, unless you've been in the ministry, you can't fully appreciate, I believe, the pain of those accusations. It was not Moses' idea to leave his tranquil life shepherding sheep in the desert to go back to Egypt. It was not Moses' idea to wage a running gun battle with Pharaoh. It was not his idea to get sniped at by the Israelites while he's simply trying to carry out God's mission in their behalf. And then, after Egypt, have them complaining and barking at him and impugning his motives, of all things, every time they hit a pothole in the road. One marvels that Moses didn't capitulate to the temptation of many pastors in those situations, just to wash his hands of them and leave them to their own devices. It was to Moses' everlasting credit that he saw himself as God's servant, not theirs primarily, and Moses carried on and took their flack as burdensome as it was. That is just one of the things that goes on with the ministry. A lot of guff, a lot of grumbling, a lot of murmuring. You have to remember when you're a servant of God who you are serving, or you'll get buried. You have to leave your reputation and your credibility to God. I'll tell you why. Perverse people for whom truth is no object, they will not hesitate to slander, to spin, to misrepresent, or in fact to do whatever is necessary to hurt you. Just look at the way this generation of Israelites, most of whom were really at bottom unbelievers, look how they treated Moses, and Aaron, and then look how they treated the rest of the prophets and the apostles. Well, you look at that, and then you'll know the drill. I've mentioned this before when on an earlier occasion, Pharaoh was bearing down on the children of Israel with his army just before they crossed the Red Sea, that all of a sudden, here they are, not very far into the wilderness, and they've begun to romanticize or idealize their days in Egypt. It's unbelievable. All of a sudden, their hardships in the wilderness, despite all the mighty works of God they have seen in liberating them from Egyptian oppression, despite all they had seen of God in extricating them from threatening situations on their Exodus march, their hardships in the wilderness are causing them to look back on their Egyptian bondage as, unbelievably, the good old days. They whine, they grumble, as if they had exchanged a regular bed of roses and a big bowl of cherries for a row of thorns. What an insult to the grace of God. Folks, this was sheer fantasy. Slaves in no nation on earth that I know of were ever treated to such fine fare. If in Egypt they had lived in Fat City, why was it, as recounted back in chapter 2, verses 23 and 24, the sons of Israel sighed because of their bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God, and the Lord took notice of them. And all of a sudden they're saying that they lived in Fat City? Apart from their attitude being a slap in the face of God, who had redeemed them by the hand of Moses, his servant, one has to ask, by what kind of psychological dynamic could these people now, just a short time in the wilderness, of all things, how could they be in such denial and labor under such fantasies about their former well-being in Egypt compared to their present estate in the desert? There is no excuse, but it may be helpful to understand it, because what they're doing here is not all that uncommon. We have all seen it. So what's the root of it? False expectations are often at the root of this kind of reaction. Folks, false expectation leads to exaggerated disappointment with an outcome. That, in turn, can cause people in their anger over their frustration at the unexpected, bad way things have turned out. It can cause them to lie or delude themselves about how they once had things, especially if there is someone around to blame for their disappointment. Israel wanted badly to be free of Egyptian oppression, but I'm quite certain they thought, if I may put it so, that when they started their march of liberation from Egypt under the mighty hand of God, well, they thought they were going, as it were, straight to heaven. All their problems were over, clear sailing ahead. But what they did not understand is that that is not the life of faith. They did not understand that God's program in their lives did not create for them a comfortable, cushy existence, but God so designed and orchestrated their experience to cause them to know Him. God so designed and orchestrated their experience to teach them the ways of God and to teach them to trust Him implicitly in any and all circumstances, good and bad. That they did not foresee, and that they did not want any part of. They wanted the gravy, but none of the grief. False expectations dashed. They proceeded to try to blame and shame Moses by hyping how good things used to be when they were in Egypt. That was a delusion. For all their testing in the wilderness, their world was so much better now, and their future so much more hopeful than it had ever been back there. Well, I have seen that same psychology, and I've warned people about the danger. I've seen it when people leave the secular workplaces and come to work in a Christian setting. The risk is, I've seen it often, that such folk come into a Christian work setting with false expectations. They somehow think that going to work for a Christian organization is a camp meeting. It's a place where employees do nothing but sit around, sing songs, pray, share testimonies, and get warm fuzzies all day and get paid for it. Might be some exaggeration there, but you get the idea. They think all the regimentation, the work rules, expectations, the accountability, all those are out the window in a Christian setting. They somehow get the idea that it really doesn't matter whether or not one performs or comes to work on time or whatever. It's all just a regular Shangri-La. And when they find out a Christian ministry or a Christian employment has to operate to some extent in a business-like manner, oh boy, it shatters their mythical paradigm, and all of a sudden they become disillusioned and disgruntled. So, I've seen it. They began to tell everybody in sight how much better things were back at Acme Manufacturing, where unbelievers treated them better than Christians. Of course, that is patently false. When they were back there in business Egypt, they were disillusioned and so looked forward to working in a Christian setting. What was the problem? Well, they came in with unrealistic expectations. And this causes them to wildly exaggerate the unpleasantness of the Christian setting and to seriously minimize the distasteful aspects of the secular workplace, and in fact, to make of it something that never existed. In this process, dear friends, God is dishonored, because really, when we talk like that, we're telling all and sundry that, in effect, the things of the world are superior to the ways and things of God. That may not be what they intended to say, but that is what they're really implying, and it slurs the Lord. That is one reason why I, in my pastoral role, go out of my way to teach people the necessary realities of the Christian life. Jesus did that and the apostles. In the rhythms of the walk of faith, the Lord will, as I've said before, He will in one season lead us beside still waters, and He will make our souls lie down in green pastures. Thank God for that. But at another time, it is necessary for our spiritual training, folks, and for our discipline that we vacate the oasis of Elim with its perhaps symbolical 12 trees and 70 palm dates for a date with another round of austerity. As the Apostle Peter plainly told us, do not think in this world that it's a strange thing if fiery trials come upon you, brothers, sisters. Look, this temporal world is for us the wilderness. It's not Canaan or heaven. Well, the Lord is merciful beyond imagination. He said to Moses, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instruction. It will come about on the sixth day when they prepare what they bring in. There will be twice as much as they gather daily. So Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel at evening, you will know that the Lord brought you out of the land of Egypt, not me. And in the morning, you will see the glory of the Lord, not my glory, for He hears your grumblings against the Lord. And what are we that you grumble against us? Moses said, this will happen when the Lord gives you meat or flesh to eat in the evening, and bread to the full in the morning. For the Lord hears your grumblings, verse 8, which you grumble against Him. You think it's against us, really. Your argument is with Him. And what are we? Your grumblings are not against us. In fact, they're really against the Lord. Well, in verse 4, God tells the congregation through Moses that I will rain bread from heaven for you. The people will go out. They're going to gather a day's portion every day. And I'm doing all this that I may test them, whether or not they will walk in my instructions. The Lord is giving them opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to finally show. The Lord promises to make supernatural provision for their sustenance. So He tells them through Moses He's going to rain food from heaven. That is, He will create a supernatural food source to keep them alive in the improvident desert. The Lord promises it'll be there every day. All that is required is for them to gather up what the Lord supplies 6 days a week. Well, what about the seventh day? Well, He says in verse 5, it will come about on the sixth day that when you prepare what you bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. So they don't need to worry about what they're going to eat on the seventh day, the Sabbath, because God will make certain that the provision of each sixth day will be double that on the seventh. Now, here is another classic example of what I have previously called in the study designer history. This miracle supply was a real historical event. It occurred continuously throughout the 40 years of the wilderness wandering of Israel. It ceased when Israel finally entered the land of Canaan, their promised land. the land which was, as God had promised them, flowing with milk and honey, with abundance. But the Lord crafted, I say, this chapter in the life of the nation. The Lord had set up designer history. He had set up the famine crisis and then made the provision for their need in a way to foreshadow or prophetically symbolize the life-giving provision that God would later make for the eternal salvation of all mankind. That intentional symbolism is clear as crystal from the teaching of the Lord Jesus himself in John chapter 6, where he declares himself the bread of heaven. Jesus said he was the true bread of life who descended from heaven. The other bread, manna, Jesus says, was only a symbol of the real bread, which brings eternal life. The provision of manna, which God is about to make here in the narrative of Exodus 16, was a supernatural provision of heaven, just as was the Lord Jesus Christ. Manna, however, only sustained their physical life temporarily. Jesus Christ is God's provision to give us spiritual life eternally. Just as the manna would do no one any good who failed to gather it and partake of it, so one must embrace Jesus Christ as the heaven-sent bread of life and partake of him. As he said, partake of my flesh, drink my blood and partake of my flesh. Just as their physical life was here in Exodus 16, supported by daily consumption of the manna, so, folks, our spiritual life is sustained and invigorated by the daily communion with Jesus Christ. Our sovereign God, who directs the currents of history, designed in advance, I'm saying, circumstances and events and provisions to sustain them. And these circumstances would telegraph symbolically spiritual realities, and they would manifest not only his foreknowledge of the future, but his sovereign control of the outworking of events. And he did this so that we, his people, we might look back in the pages of his revelation, we might see these things written so long ago and marvel at the sovereign hand of God, be edified, be comforted, and assured that he who has begun a good work in us is entirely competent to finish it and bring you and I at last into his presence and glory. The sixth-day provision of a double supply anticipates the formal institution of the Sabbath observance 2 months later when God reveals to Moses the rituals and regulations that are to hereafter mark the way he wanted Israel to worship him. From Genesis 2:3, it said, God rested on the seventh day and sanctified it, set it apart. That is, he made it holy and set it apart for himself. So from Genesis 2:3, we can infer that the observance of the Sabbath day, though necessarily fallen into disuse under the conditions of slavery in Egypt, the Sabbath day was known to the patriarchs, just as some knowledge of the necessity of blood sacrifices in approaching God was in evidence from the time of Cain and Abel. What we have here amounts to the reinstitution of the Sabbath observance in advance of its formal legislation on Mount Sinai. The Lord wants them to treat the seventh day as a sacred day to honor him. And right now, one way of doing that was to lay low and not go out as on other days, foraging for food, but simply to trust God's ample supply on the sixth day to tide them over. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.